Hello and welcome to A Responsible Day for the 25th day of Adar Sheni. Today we're going to have a chance to learn from Rav Yitzchak Herzog, first Ashkenazi Chief Rabbi of the State of Israel, and Shut Heichal Yitzchak, the Or HaChaim section, Siman Lamed Zayin, responsible number 37. Let's thank the OU, Rabbi Jacob Romitz and David Hochhauser, for making this shiurim available to you. And let's note that this tshuva, this responsible day, the 25th of Adar Bet, 25th of Adar Sheni, of Tafshin Chet, of 1948, which means this responsum is written just before the State of Israel is declared, about 6 weeks before, because there's the end of Adar Bet, and there's Nisan, is 4 weeks, basically, and then Iyar, and the 5th of Iyar, is the day the state is declared. So this is earlier than that, but there's already war going on, because from the time the British announced their pullout, there's fighting going on in Israel. So the question is about Dinei Shabbat Matzav Milchama, the laws of Shabbos at a time of war. Now, I don't remember all the shiurim that I do at all. I'm going to start, collating them and reminding myself of them, going through them all and seeing what running themes, what overall structure you get. But it happens to me that I do remember that we've seen at least two other tshuvot of Herzog's that have to do with war. There was a question of how you write gittin for soldiers going to war who might not have children. You want to help them avoid, help their, God forbid, widows avoid problems of yibum should they come up. And then there was one to the Gush Etzion, that when they were besieged, about how they could keep Shabbos while they were besieged. So this is going to be another one of those Shabbos questions of how to conduct Shabbos during war. It's a reminder that Rav Herzog, now it could be that I noticed those tshuvot and used them more than others, and then some of that is on me, rather than reflective anything about Rav Herzog, but it's a reminder that one of the challenges for a halakhic Jew is when you come to having a state and there's war going on, you have to make all sorts of hard decisions. This tshuva is certainly going to be filled with hard decisions, where the halakha is in fact clear, but the evaluation of the facts is significant to determining the halakha, and that's going to be not clear, and that's going to be a place where, to some extent, the more, it's not the term I like, but the more Zionistic you are, you'll experience the facts in one way, and the more you think of the state as a problematic situation, you might experience the facts a different way. So that's all sort of underlying here. For Herzog, it's early in the state, and I think it was a time when Jews we would today think of as Zionistic were extremely excited about the possibility that this state was going to become something not just what it is today, which has many, many great things to it, but more, I think, would get closer to full observance than we are at today in the state of Israel. And they were very, very enthusiastic about the possibility. And I think that's sort of a current running underneath all of what's going on here. So there's a place in the south of Israel, I think it's west of Kiryat Malachi, from what I could tell when I looked it up online, called Tuvia Beer. So it's a moshav, and you can look it up if you want to. I'm not going to give you many more details about that, but they have a help society, meaning they have a self-protection society. There's not so much of a formal army yet, because there's no state of Israel yet. There's the Haganah, there's, the Etzel, the Lechi. There's all sorts of groups. So they have an Irgun. They have an Irgun Ezra. They have a group that banded together to help themselves. And the question is, first of all, they want to know, Hamutar b'Shabbat li nadev lepeulot hagana misuyamot. Can you volunteer on Shabbos to do self-defensive actions in ways that will obviously have to violate Shabbat? Well, question one is, are you allowed to? And question two is, maybe you're obligated to. In addition, so let's say that's about issues of defense. Let's say it's not a question of defense. Let's say it's a question of attack. But the attack is for defensive purposes, meaning it's not defense yet, but let's say you can see people coming, 3 miles down the road, and they're coming to attack you, so you attack them instead, even though they weren't about to attack you. They're there, they were going to camp there for a while, but if you attack them now, it'll defend the settlement better, the Mirshav better. That would be question two. Then, let's say it's just an attack, and it doesn't have direct self-defense purposes, but theoretically, I guess, by attacking them, you're going to expand your boundaries and your borders, and you're going to clear out an area of them, and that, in that sense, it might be to self-defense, but it's not fundamentally a self-defense situation. It's fundamentally an attack. Can you do that on Shabbos as well? Now, moving away from attacks, can you on Shabbat take a tour of an area within a city or around the city in a car? Meaning, can you drive the car to patrol, basically, is what we're talking about. Can you do patrols in cars on Shabbos when there's no specific threat that you know of, you're just trying to make sure of it. Then the final question here is, can you keep a log, right? Can you keep, the word is yoman, which often you think of as a diary, but can you write in a log on Shabbos? That would be maybe a log for marking the movements of the enemy. And you see it, you know, so I'm watching Shmirah Friday night, and I'm watching, and I see the enemy moving here and here and here, and I want to record it in the log, and presumably it's that so that people can come and know what's been happening and be aware of it. And then the second question is, let's say it's not going to be for what the enemy's doing, but let's say I'm supervising, you know, the defense procedures, and I'm supervising various soldiers or various people who are have various jobs within the defense of the people, and I want to log that down for the purpose of keeping a record of it. Can I do that on Shabbos as well? Sorry, one last one. The sixth one is, can, if they have a checkpoint, can they stop cars on Shabbos, which they have a checkpoint to do so, and then turn on and off the flashlight to check the people there? So that's a violation of Shabbat, but is it enough self-defense that you're allowed to do it? So Herzog starts off by saying, I'm working with the assumption that we have to rely on the commanders in these situations. And then he writes, Sharei im lo kein, ein le davar sof, v'lo yekiyum l'pulot ha'agana. You can't rely on the commanders to say this is necessary and this is necessary. If you don't rely on them, then there's no end to who's going to say. Then everybody's going to have their own view, and you can't run an army that way. You can't run a country that way. Or you have to have people who are in charge, and the people who are in charge have to have some ability to say this is the way we're doing it, and have other people follow them. Because everybody's going to question everybody. You won't get anywhere, especially in matters of defense. So if we say that, and if we agree, and if the commander has decided that there are a certain number of people needed for this defensive activity, and we have the general assumption, this I don't think is actually a question, that on Shabbos you're allowed to violate Shabbat in order to do a necessary defensive activity to save one's life. So then the question here is just, he's saying, but you can trust the commander to define it that way. So he thinks there's no room for the question. Were it to be a non-Jewish army, he says, so then you could have the question, because you could say the whole reason why the Jewish soldier is allowed to violate Shabbat is that he's forced to. And if he doesn't follow his commander, he'll get punished, and it's saving his own soul, as Pikuach Nefesh, for himself. But then there's no reason to volunteer. He can just say, if it's a volunteer question, I'll leave it to other people, and maybe this soldier will volunteer when it's not Shabbat in order to keep a good standing with his unit and with his commanders and people like that. Because after all, in a non-Jewish army, the non-Jewish soldiers aren't allowed to be keeping Shabbat. Our tradition is that non-Jews are not allowed to keep Shabbat until they convert to Judaism. They can do everything else just about if they want to, but Shabbat they're not allowed to keep. That's a special gift of Hashem's to the Jewish people. So you should hope that they are the ones who volunteer. You should make them volunteer. But in a Jewish army, right, so it's permissible to violate Shabbat for these purposes because they're defending the Jewish people. So there isn't the question whether you can volunteer. You can certainly volunteer as well. Now, the truth is, he thinks that it's a matter of defense and war. He points out here and later in the response, but I'll just say it here, that there's two ways you could look at armies fighting on behalf of the state of Israel on Shabbat. When it's Jewish army in the state of Israel, there's the idea of Milchamot Yisrael, the Jewish people wage war. That's a value of its own that also allows violating Shabbat in many circumstances. And then there's the question of saving many, many lives. Pikuach Nefesh Dirabim. So those are not the same. It's not purely when the Jewish people go to war, it's not only a matter of saving many, many Jewish lives that's at stake. Even just the pursuit, the proper performance of a war for the Jewish people has its own halachic standing, which also allows sometimes violating Shabbat. But let's stick for a second, he says, with the idea of Pikuach Nefesh Rabim, of saving public lives, many lives in the public, and therefore, he says, Kfar Nifsak B'Brayta Yoma Daf Pei Gimel. We already have a Brayta in the Gemara in Yoma, that when it comes to saving lives, we don't delegate it to, I won't give you the example of the Gemara, but we don't delegate it to the people who we think of as like the lesser people in society and say, oh, let them go do it. We do it, Ayidei Gedolei Yisrael V'Chachameihem, is where the Rambam says it. We make sure the great scholars of the Jewish people and their wise people are the ones who get involved. He writes that in the chapter 22 of Hilchot Shabbat, Halacha Gimel, and the reason is, the Rambam is giving it, is two possibilities. One is, they'll know better the limits of what to do and what not to do and how the best way to do it, but I think that's not even what the Rambam is really emphasizing. The Rambam is really emphasizing is that will make clear to everybody that saving Jewish lives is a vital, important need, and when there's a Jewish life that's in danger on Shabbat, we rush to save it, and we think more, we think as much as we can at the time about avoiding ways of doing it, you know, violating Shabbat if we can. But more important than that is that we make sure that we don't err at all on the side of caution in terms of making sure we can save this Jewish life. So that would be true here as well. And therefore, if a Jew were to say, well, you know, other people can do it, and there's, you know, but it's a Jewish army, and we're saving Jewish lives, and it's part of the defense of the land of Israel, Rav Herzog is saying, it's not really appropriate for you to say, let somebody else do it, and therefore they probably should volunteer. And then, if you have a stronger background, like he says here, Shazoi Milchemet Yisrael Baratzo, it's a war of the Jewish people in its land, and therefore that makes it either Milchemet Mitzvah or Chovah. It's a sort of obligatory war. We don't have to get into the definitions of the war in particular, but if, the more obligatory the war is, the more room it leaves for allowing various things, then certainly there's no room for this question, and you should just go off and do it. Now, the piece that I would add here that sort of comes up a little bit later, but I think it's worth bringing up here, if I wish I had Rav Herzog around to ask it, and I think over time it's become more clear that we have to think in these ways, is that if you can trust the commander to factor in the issue of Shabbat as he makes a decision about what's necessary and what's not necessary. And I don't mean that the commander has to say, no, this is absolutely life-saving right now. I don't mean that. The commander thinks it's necessary for the defense of this settlement or of the country at large or of a, you know, important road. If you could trust that the commander would only say that if it's actually necessary. So then I hear exactly what Herzog's saying, and I have no questions about it whatsoever. Sadly, I think there are many commanders in the Israeli army, certainly back then, I think now too as well, who don't factor that in. Meaning, many years ago, in a completely different context, somebody, you know, confidently made a statement about how medicine and halakha should interact in a certain halakhic situation. It's not important for us, that's why I'm not telling you the story. But, you know, I went to a rabbi, he said, well, you should ask the X question. So you ask X question, it turns out, the doctor wasn't really just thinking about it. The doctor said, this is absolutely necessary. You asked a simple question, he said, well, no, you could do it that way too. So that's the kind of issue that I think Rav Herzog is not quite grappled with here. He's just, and I understand why he's doing it. He's at a state of war, even though it's undeclared because there's no state of Israel yet, and people are getting killed, and all that's important stuff to know. But with commanders, there's that hard question. Are they sensitized to the issues? Not that they're going to be Shomer Shabbos, not they're going to take it fully into account, but they're sensitized to the issue such they won't confidently say, no, this is absolutely necessary, unless they really think it's necessary. Then going on to the question of attacks for self-defense purposes, right, where you're not being attacked, or you don't think that what you're manning is a defense mission, that you're going to go on the attack, but you think that attack will help us in defense, and therefore it's not quite as clear that it's permitted. Nonetheless, again, since the commander, who we are treating as the expert on this issue, so which is probably true, since the commander has decided, although again, and in today's army, it's worth also paying the fact that these commanders, I've heard, I am reached an age where I have friends whose kids are soldiers, and they talk about how these commanders are 20 and 21-year-olds. So they've been in the army for a while, and they maybe have fought battles, and they've practiced things, they know a lot of stuff, but they're still 20 and 21-year-olds. So, but in any case, since they're the experts, as far as we can tell, and an expert has decided that this activity, this attack, will save Jewish lives, or will have a defense value to it. So again, he thinks, Herzog thinks, that makes it a kind of pikuach nefesh, or a kind of saving Jews from an enemy that's coming on them, and that, in the Rambam, makes it into a milchemet mitzvah, into an obligatory war, into a war that every Jew has to go and join. And he throws in parentheses, what I think is an important parenthesis. He says, you know, we didn't start this war, and everything that we're doing is fundamentally defensive because we just want them to leave us alone. So that would fit the Rambam's standard of Ezra Yisrael Miyatzar, of saving Jews from the enemies around them. And I'm still in the middle of, I'm working on, hopefully by the time you hear this tape, I have finished it, but Professor Binyamin Brown in Israel has a remarkable, remarkable biography of the Chazon Ish, and he just points out in a certain point of it that in the War of Independence, the Chazon Ish wasn't, and other, what we would call maybe today, Haredi or right-wing Rabbanim, were not as opposed to people going to the army or helping out with the army, at least as they have solidified those positions today. Because at the time it was pretty clear that it was saving Jews from enemies who are coming to them. And that's a war that the Rambam and that we just generally assume is obligatory on all Jews. Then he points out a Tosos that's relevant to this discussion, but that came up in another context. Tosos from Sakim on the Memvav Amid Bet on 46b, Tosos points out that there are times when we're allowed to do certain actions on Shabbat and we'll say, Hoil. that since something could be used for a chola sheyesh bo sakana, he had somebody who was deathly ill, that, you know, let's say if I slaughtered it, then he could need meat, but I don't have any meat ready, so I'll slaughter an animal on Shabbat, which is usually prohibited on Shabbat. I will slaughter an animal on Shabbat, and maybe there will be a chola who will need it, and that would make it allowed. So Tosa says, if you think like that, the Gemara there seems to think that you're allowed to think like that. So he says, if you think like that, you can do everything on Shabbos. You can say, well, maybe it'll be necessary for somebody who's deathly ill. Now the answer there is, shecholeza kaze lo shachiach, that you can't use that logic because you don't usually get deathly ill people on Shabbat. Now, Rav Herzog points out, and I'm not sure Tosa would take it as far as he's about to, because the loophole he's going to point out becomes a huge loophole. He says, in our current situation, it's very common that you have danger. So once again, as long as somebody says the situation of danger here, he thinks that it's allowed. As long as a commander says situation of danger, he's going to allow many, many things. That's one. This is one of those things that come up in lots of Chivot in Eretz Yisrael of definition of facts. What constitutes saving lives? What constitutes protection? What constitutes this? And that affects Shmirat Shabbat in a huge number of ways. I once in Rav Nachum Rabinovich, his chuvot or not in my Bar Ilan project thing, so he could be part of this, and I don't remember if he dated his chuvot, but I once saw a chuvah of his where he talks about responding to terrorist attacks, and he was clear that on Shabbat a psychologist or a therapist of some sort could travel to violate Shabbat to the site of where the injured were, because psychological help would also be part of saving their lives. And he raised the possibility that the mayor of a town, right, a political figure, might also be allowed to violate Shabbat to go visit them, because that too might constitute enough of like an encouraging sign for them that the people injured or wounded would feel better enough for them. It could have a saving life component. I think it's a very interesting idea. I'm not sure I would feel comfortable ruling that way, but it highlights the extent to which interpretation of facts becomes vital to these kinds of halachot. So once again, he thinks that a preemptive attack for defensive purposes, basically what he's talking about, could easily be possible, certainly for saving lives, and even more so if we're talking about a war for the Jewish people to conquer the land of Israel, to be able to hold on to the land of Israel. Now, when you come to attacks that you don't have any specific defense purpose in the attack that you can think of, so if it's a part of the war for the land of Israel, then it should be okay. If it's saving lives, it doesn't seem to be saving lives, although he then says, but it's not really true, because it will ultimately save lives if we defeat them and if we beat them. So every attack we do, even if it's just it seems like an offensive attack, just for the purpose of making a strategic point, the more we win and the faster we win, the more lives will be saved. Now he paused to say why he also is pretty sure that this war that they're fighting should be considered a milchemet mitzvah. A milchemet mitzvah, as I said before, is a war that's obligatory on all Jews, and that it's just like it's required to be part of it. But usually, he says, a milchemet mitzvah needs to be cleared by a Jewish king. And we don't have a Jewish king. So he reminds us that Rav Kook had already said previously that when the Enshut Mishpat Kohen, Kuf Mem Dalet, response number 144, that if the entire Jewish people or its majority, the entire Jewish community or its majority make a decision, that counts in important senses as if a king had made that decision. Rav Kook distinguishes between Melech and Malchut, and that why there's no Melech Yisrael, there is a Malchut Yisrael. And a Malchut Yisrael is what the entire Jewish people decide should be done, and we always say that a majority is like the whole, and therefore if the majority does it, that's going to be like a king had did it. So here too, if the entirety of the Jewish population of Israel, or its majority, and then he throws in shehu bevachinat kol kehal Yisrael, and that counts as the Jewish community at large. This is a point that my Rebbe, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein Zecher Tzedakah, made in a couple of occasions that I've seen, and I assume that means he made it a bunch of other times. There's a Gemara in Horiot that talks about the fact that Hani Ikre Kahal and then Achri Lo Ikre Kahal, that the Jews who live in Israel are called the Kahal Yisrael. So for those of us still stuck in the exile, it's worth paying attention to that statement, that what makes up the community are really the Jews of Eretz Israel. So therefore, if Herzog feels comfortable saying that if the Jewish people in Israel, the majority of Jewish people in Israel, have decided this is a war, that's an obligation, it's an obligation. And that's also an interesting claim that can have ramifications for other things, such as where are we allowed to ignore what the majority wants to do in Israel, and who counts, who doesn't count, or whatever, and where do we allow ourselves to say, well, I don't care what the majority said, I'm going to do something else. But if the majority counts as like a king, in terms of Melch versus Malchut, then the person who refuses to do it is to some extent rebelling against the Jewish people. Not that I'm going to take it that way today because it would be too politically complicated, but I think it's a factor to think about from halakhic terms. People who care about halakha should have to think about that question. If the majority of the Jewish people say something, Rav Herzog is telling us, the majority of the Jewish people in Israel say something, that's a decision of the Jewish nation. It would be akin to the decision of a Jewish king, and you have that factor there. And then Rav Herzog adds, and by the way, the whole question of whether an attack can qualify, a purely offensive attack can qualify as saving Jewish lives, which is not obviously wrong. It might be that even just that fair statement is true. Rav Herzog says, that whole question is only where the non-Jews aren't currently doing anything to us. So there's still room to say, because we suspect that in the future they will, or we have a problem. So for example, today, let's suppose that the Gaza Strip is run by Hamas, and we know that Hamas people are people who would love to kill the Jewish people. So even if there's nothing going on right now, you might argue that, and I'm not saying we should do it, I'm just saying as an argument for halakhic purpose, you might argue that an offensive attack to get at them, you know, and destroy their tunnels or take away their weapons or whatever is itself protecting Jews. Yeah, maybe yes, maybe no. That's an interesting question. But Rav Herzog says, but that question is only true when they're not doing anything. But right now, the situation is in 1948, that they are already attacking us. They're already making clear that they intend to destroy us. So there, even if this particular battle is completely initiated by us and was not based on the fact that there is some specific defensive need coming up, it already counts as defense because we're in a war with them in those situations. Now, here already, he makes the point that I made before. I'm just not sure that he makes it as vigorously as I would. He says, but in these kinds of situations, if you're going to do a purely offensive attack, he thinks that Jews who care about mitzvahs and observant Jews should request / demand of the command structure that they think carefully about whether they really mean this attack must happen on Shabbos or maybe it could happen on Sunday, right? Because again, that's the kind of question. If you ask it, they might say, "Nah, I guess we could do it on Sunday." But if they not. So he's not saying don't listen to them. He's still respecting their authority. He's just pointing out that we need to try to make sure that they are sensitized to the issues and factoring that into their decisions, which isn't so simple, especially if you're not a Sabbath observant Jew yourself. You don't realize the significance and the importance of it necessarily. So that's all underlying this discussion that would have to be had. In terms of taking tours, right, driving around within the town or outside the town, he says it depends. If they're necessary, right, if they're part of the defense and they can't be done by foot, then yeah. So we once saw a discussion of his about, for Tirat Tzvi, whether they do their patrols on foot or horseback. So horseback was a question because there were all sorts of halakhic complicated issues as to which was worse, horseback or carrying things on foot. When it comes to a car, that's clearly worse. So he's saying, so if you can do it on foot, you should. If you can't and it's necessary, then yeah, then go ahead and do it. And if not. When it comes to keeping the log, he says, I'm not sure what the point of the log is or why it's so necessary. If it's that you can't rely on your memory and you need these notes for the defense, then yeah, then you keep the log. But while you're keeping the log, and this would be an example of something I mentioned before, that even while we're saving lives, to the extent that there's no downside to saving lives in a way that violates Shabbat less, we're supposed to do it less if we can. So here he writes, but write it as briefly as you can, meaning make an effort to write as little as you can. Now you have to make sure, once we've decided this log is necessary to saving lives, you have to make sure that you don't write it so briefly that you then can't understand it, or so messily that you then can't read it, right? You want to make sure that it's useful, but within that, you should try to write as briefly as you can. And if you can, he says you should write with the other hand, because that lessens the Shabbat violation. And also, he says, write it in what he calls meshita, by which he means script. So I'm not sure why he has to worry about this, but it happens to be true that writing in the square block letters like they're written in the Torah, or let's say printed in regular Jewish books, so that's seen as a much higher level of writing halakhically, and therefore you shouldn't do it. Now, I think it's dealing with people who might know how to write the block letters and not know how to write the script, which I think is interesting because you know, once I learned how to write script, in my education, nobody wrote block letters anymore, but that's what he's worried about. So that's the worst thing. Then you can't write script, Hebrew script, then better maybe write it in Latin letters, meaning what we call English letters or German, the German alphabet, but some kind of an alphabet that's not that original one, because that original one is more of a don't write the violation of writing and more of a serious issue. And if it can be avoided, it should. Then for the final question, he agrees that stopping cars at checkpoints is very important to do. And he says, but I've written before, 10 years earlier, so this is 1948, 10 years earlier, there have been various riots and pogrom riots, I think. And during that time, I said that what they should do is light the flashlight before Shabbat, because turning a flashlight on at Shabbat is a violation of Shabbat. So if we don't have to, we don't want to. So light the flashlight before Shabbat. Now, you want to flash the flashlight in their face because you want to surprise them with it. So if you just had it lit and you're just going on, so that's not as good. So he says, so hold it in some kind of a black bag, and then when you want to check people, take it out of the bag, right, in such a way that it's like you're flashing it on, and then you put it back in. And he says, I had, you know, observant Jews who asked me that question, and this is the answer that I gave them. He says, I don't understand why you can't do that now. And that's what he thinks. But if there's a reason why you can't do it, so then you can turn on the flashlight on Shabbos if you have to do it that way. But here, he thinks that it's simple to do. I think it's actually, in terms of manual dexterity, not so easy to do. He says, do it with two people. So this is because it's a well-known principle in Hilchot Shabbat, in the laws of Shabbat, that if two people join in doing an action that one person could have done, that lowers the level of the violation of the prohibition, and therefore he thinks it's preferable to do it that way. So then he closes with words of encouragement to conduct the war with real care and real enthusiasm and energy, and he points out a Rambam in Hilchot Melachim who talks about that once somebody gets into war, they have to rely on Hashem, who's going to help us in our times of trouble. The best person has to do what they can do, and Yedah that this war is being fought to declare the true monotheism in the world and shouldn't have any fear, shouldn't think about his wife and children. He has to just focus on the war and be completely focused on the war. And if you think about other things, so the Rambam says you're violating the Torah's rule of verse that says al yirach levavkam, you have to make sure not to have fear and not to have a soft heart. So if Herzog is saying that means that thinking about other things than the war itself can be construed as that, or a problem of that, and then if the person doesn't fight well, that'll hurt the rest of the unit, and then lots and lots of lives, and maybe the whole loss of the war would be on this person's head. So people have to be very careful when they're fighting a war, to be fighting the war. And if they do, and they fight the war with all their energy, without fear, because they're trusting that Hashem will help them, and Tiyeh Kavanatol Kadesh Hashem, and their intent is to, only their intent is to sanctify Hashem's name, so the Rambam says, so you won't get damaged, and it'll all go well, to the extent that everybody can do that. So those are encouraging words and a reminder that that's the way we're supposed to think of war, as being part of the Jewish people's battling for the cause of spreading the recognition of Hashem in the world. And then he adds, he says, and yesh li losif biur, I want to add an explanation that the Rambam doesn't only mean when he says that this war is al yichud Hashem, is to declare monotheism in the world. The Rambam doesn't only mean a religious war where we're actually fighting against idolaters or people who worship powers other than Hashem, because he also talks about a Melchemet Reshut, and Melchemet Reshut is a voluntary war, meaning a war to expand the borders of Israel or whatever. That's not a war about religious issues. So Rav Herzog says, no, the Rambam just means that the Jewish people are representatives of Torah and of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and it's all linked together, as the Zohar writes. And the Rambam wouldn't have said that because the Rambam didn't know the Zohar, I'm pretty sure. I'm pretty sure we generally assume the Rambam didn't know the Zohar. He doesn't mean that. But he means that when the Jewish people act, even just expanding the borders of Israel, so they're the Jewish people, they're known to be the ones who speak of full monotheism, of recognizing Hashem in the fullest ways. So anything that the Jewish people do helps advance the cause of the world at large, recognizing that we have to believe in and serve and operate within a world created by one HaKadosh Baruch Hu and run by one HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that's all part of everything the Jewish people does. So you might say, says Rav Herzog, you might say, no, that's not true anymore. That's true in the Rambam's time when people didn't really believe in one God, but nowadays it's different, you might think. So Rav Herzog says it's not true, and I think there's an important message that's still true today in terms of our recognition of how far monotheism has come or hasn't come. So he says, aside from the fact that even the people you might think of naturally or instinctively as monotheists haven't absorbed the moral values of monotheism, which is a topic we can't get into now because we're running out of time. He didn't go into it, but I think it's a really important thing to think about, right? It's not just you have to believe in one God. It's that believing in one God and, you know, understanding that God created the world and understanding that that means certain rules to the world and to the way people are supposed to act. So if you see people who say, oh yeah, I believe in one God, and then they act in ways that the belief in one God should contradict, I mean, they didn't get the moral message. But he says, forget the moral message. He says, even the actual monotheism they don't have. So for example, Christians, and by Christians, I think here means mostly Catholics, certain versions of Protestants as well, who still worship the Trinity, who still believe in a Trinity in some real kind of way. So we hold halakhically that that counts as shituf. So shituf means that you think of different powers joining together to create one power. That's seen as a problem of avodah zarah, of worshiping a power other than Hashem. Now he admits, he said a tshuva, he has a response where he doesn't think that they have the full halakhot of the avodah zarah. There are plenty of halakhot in the Gemara about how we treat or refrain from interacting with those who worship powers other than Hashem. Of course, Herzog doesn't think that applies to Christians because they're not full of the avodah zarah. Even though if a Jew did it, it would count as full avodah zarah. But nonetheless, it shows that they don't really fully understand monotheism. And that was his point here. So if you had a war against Christians, however it came about, he's not saying go to war to make this point. But if you have a war against Christians, and some of the Arabs were Christians at the time, so if you have a war against Christians and we win, that helps further the cause of true monotheism. But then he says, but even Islam. Now, we all say today, the Rambam said it in his time, that Islam is a form of monotheism, and it's true, but they still uproot the belief in Torah and Moshe. They say that the Moshe's Torah isn't the only Torah that we have to believe in, isn't the only truths of God that we have to accept, and they certainly deny that the Torah Sheba'al Peh, the oral law, has truth to it. And again, says Rav Herzog, real monotheism won't spread in the world if the monotheism they're spreading is a different one. That's a vital point, that there's a thing called monotheism, but just because we use the word monotheism and it's accurate doesn't mean they've captured all the truths about Hashem that are necessarily and vital. And therefore, winning these wars will be part of spreading our ideas and our understanding and our truths of the way Hashem works and what Hashem wants from all people, not just Jews, in the world. And therefore, in all these ways, if somebody brings about a time when there will be more success for that, they're advancing, first off, that the world will see Hashem better, and even that Jews who currently today don't see the world appropriately and properly as the truth has it, so they'll come closer to it as well, and will lead to a time of the spread of the truths of Hashem in all its possible ways, and we'll see, you know, great Yeshua, and we'll hope for great salvation that can come any moment. So that is Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Herzog for the 25th of Adar Sheni of Tavshin Ched of 1948, reminding us of lots of issues of fighting wars, lots of issues of saving lives on Shabbat, and lots of issues of remembering there's a lot of work left to do in terms of ushering in a world where everybody understands what the truths of these worlds are, starting with the creator of the world. Thank you to Rabbi Jacob Bromwitz, to David Achaz, and to the OU. Thank you for joining me in a project that in a couple of days is going to be basically over for us because Adar Sheni doesn't come around that often. I'll see you next time.